Up next, Paul DeBoyle joins us. We're going to be talking about the JFK assassination and how it points to a conspiracy. And welcome back to Coast. Paul DeBoyle is an assistant professor of political science at LaSalle College, a small private college just west of Boston. At LaSalle, he teaches courses in American government, the American presidency, American political institutions, and perhaps his most popular course, listen to this, the conspiracy in American politics. Paul, welcome to the program, and thanks for staying up so late with us.
Well, I had to baste the turkey anyhow, George, so no problem.
Something we got to start doing pretty soon. It's almost that time.
It is.
Conspiracy course. Tell me about that.
Well, it's primarily designed as a tool to encourage students in their interests in research and writing. So, and who doesn't love a conspiracy? So we start with the Salem witch trials. We move to the Lincoln kidnapping and then to the Lincoln assassination. We move into Sacco and Vanzetti. We spend a lot of time on JFK, RFK, Watergate, et cetera. And what it does is it gives the students just an opportunity to kind of indulge themselves in an area that in which they are interested. And it produces some really nice research. It produces some really good papers. And, you know, the problem with any, you know, political science course is it's usually torturous getting 25 pages out of a student. But for some reason in a conspiracy course, I have to limit them to 30 pages on the final page.
Wow.
If I let them go, they'd be doing 60, 70, 80 pages. So,
what led you to the JFK assassination as part of the course?
Well, I mean, when we're talking about conspiracies, I mean, that's the big one. And, you know, I was very, very young at the time, but I remember sitting on the living room floor and my parents watching the news, and they were both crying over what was on the news. And then as I got older, you know, you study JFK in history, and then for one reason or another, I ended up picking up the Warren Commission report and kind of reading through, you know, large sections of it, just scratching my head saying, well, that doesn't make sense, that doesn't look like it was done. And then, you know, opportunity came for additional research, etc. And the thing that's so fascinating about the JFK assassination is that so many people put it off to coincidence. And when you start to tally up the coincidences, you come to the conclusion that this cannot be a random confluence of events, that there had to be some type of deeper underlying conspiracy. And there are more theories, you know, regarding the JFK assassination that you can shake a stick at. But if you kind of focus in on certain things in Oswald's behavior, in Oswald's property, the people that were involved in the Warren Commission and the reason that they were, you come to this inescapable conclusion that there's something deeper going on here.
Are most of the students, when they look at the JFK assassination, convinced that this was a conspiracy? It was not just Lee Harvey Oswald or even him at all?
About 85% of them are convinced that
God, that's huge.
There's some underlying conspiracy, and I don't think that's atypical of the population as a whole. I mean, I had seen a survey one time where 70% of the U.S. population believed that there was some greater conspiracy involving JFK, but you know, we have this concept called layered conspiracy as well. And what happens in a layered conspiracy is that you have some underlying event that, where there may or sometimes may not be a conspiracy, and then you have actions on behalf of government to control information and to limit access to information. And you can take the definition of conspiracy in a legal sense and just kind of just move it a little more forward when you're talking about government and government agencies and how they function. You can come to a greater definition of conspiracy, which is that there is some event out there, and the information that's in the public sphere is demonstrably false. And you have action on behalf of government agencies and government officials to limit access to correct information. And the theory behind that is that if the truth were known, it would cause people to view government in a negative light, or
right,
elected officials in a negative light. And we can't have that because that's dangerous to our system.
Have you always been a believer that the JFK assassination was a bigger part of a conspiracy?
Starting from my early readings, yeah. I think in my late teens, I think I came to that conclusion that, you know, there were people involved there. I mean, there were so many, you know, books that were written and so much eyewitness testimony about people seeing other people with guns. There's the fascination of the grassy knoll. There's President Kennedy's head snapping back, you know, on frame 313 of the Zapruder film. When the fatal shot came, and just a lot of things just don't make sense to the average person. And the nice thing about the average person is that they can usually figure out what's going on pretty quickly. They might just not have all of the facts and evidence to buttress their beliefs. So,
Paul, what did you think of the Warren Commission report?
You know, it was kind of funny. The Warren Commission report was, well, the reason why I suspected something deeper with the Warren Commission was, you know, when President Johnson appointed Earl Warren, who was a man of impeccable
integrity
and credentials, and then you looked at the members of the commission, and, you know, Alan Dulles was on the commission,
yeah,
who was forced to resign by President Kennedy.
He hated Kennedy.
Less than a year before, and it just seemed like an odd choice because there were so many great prosecutors, there were so many great investigators with the federal government, that it just didn't seem like a logical choice to put on the Warren Commission, and that kind of caused me to scratch my head, even as a very, very young man. And there was pressure on the Warren Commission to wrap up their report in advance of the November 1964 election. And if you're looking at the truth, you really can't. If you're conducting a wide-ranging investigation and you're looking for the truth, you really can't put that on a time limit, or at least a time limit that's that short. I mean, one of the most amazing things about the Warren Commission was that Marianne Moorman, who was probably within 8 to 10 feet of President Kennedy when he took the, when he received the fatal shot, actually took a really interesting Polaroid photograph at that moment, and she was not brought before. I mean, she was called before the Warren Commission. She had some medical problems, and because they had this arbitrary timeline, she was never called upon to give her testimony after the rescheduling. So it seemed like shoddy work at best.
You have looked at this case for some time now, and you've come up obviously with your own thoughts and your own theories. What is your favorite theory?
Right now, my favorite theory is that there was some type of CIA involvement in the assassination, and that's for a variety of reasons. You know, President Kennedy made several statements after the Bay of Pigs invasion that he wanted to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces, and if you're in the CIA, you view what you're doing as very, very important.
Right,
you're doing the Lord's work. And it would be dangerous to national security, it would be dangerous to their careers, it would be dangerous to the whole defense intelligence complex to have an agency that, by and large, does some very good work, broken up for political reasons. So, I mean, there's a huge impetus for the CIA to keep functioning the way that they are and doing things the way they are. And anything that upsets the apple cart is usually suspect to some type of monitoring, review, or in some cases, direct action.
In those days, they had small cameras. One was called a Minox. You focus in on this. Tell me why.
Because there are some things that are just odd. I mean, you could look at Oswald as playing a role in the conspiracy, and I don't think his role was major. I think he was a willing dupe to be used as some type of cutout. Or he could have been a spy wannabe, but, you know, obviously I have way too much time on my hands, so I spend part of it going through the digitized files that the city of Dallas has. And when you go through the Dallas Police Department property inventory of things that were seized when they searched Oswald's apartment, there was one notation on one of those inventory forms about a Minox camera. And, you know, I've always been a big James Bond fan, et cetera, and I know a Minox camera is a very, very small camera. The lens has a very small focal length, and what it's really good for is photographing documents. it's not something that you would normally buy to take pictures of your children, for example, at, you know, at the park or swimming in the pool. And they have this Minox camera listed on his on the property inventory. And in like in 1962, 1963, a Minox camera is probably going for about $300. It's top of the line. And if you're making $60 a week, $70 a week, you know, moving books at the Texas School Book Depository or in any of the other, you know, lower level jobs that Oswald had, you know, how long do you not feed your children for in order to save up enough money to buy a Minox camera? It's just, it's something that stands out to me as being very atypical in the property inventory. If he had an older Yashica camera or even a Kodak camera, which he did, that's fine. That's typical.
That's his budget. Right.
Yeah, but a Minox camera, I mean, that's upper-level spy stuff that just the average person would not have in their possession. There was a book, I read an article recently, and the name of the author escapes me, where that researcher actually found a purchase order for the OSS for X number of those Minox cameras. OSS was the World War II equivalent of the CIA. So it seems as though the Minox camera would be standard issue for someone who was engaged in an intelligence gathering function.
Yeah, and they were small, weren't they?
But yeah, I mean, if you Google Minox camera and go to images, I mean, they'll pretty much fit in the palm of your hand. And again, you know, 1962, 1963, that's pretty much cutting edge. There were several models. There was the A, there was the B, there was the C. I think it was the Model C that was in his possession, which was something fairly newer, so that would indicate a more recent purchase.
Let's talk about the two wallets that were involved in this inventory. What's the significance of
them? Well, the wallets weren't in the inventory. They're just. But when you read the investigators' reports from the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit, Oswald's wallet was found at the scene of his murder. Yet when he was arrested at the movie theater, he had a wallet on him. I mean, I don't carry two wallets. I don't know anyone that carries two wallets.
No.
It seems odd. But for a spy wannabe, you know, that might be typical. Or was the wallet planted there? We just don't know.
Do you believe that this assassination was conducted by the mob?
You know, there's a lot of mob theories. There's the theory that President Kennedy and Sam Giancana, Sir Carlos Marcellus, you know, shared a common mistress, et cetera.
Yeah.
There were allegations that, you know, the alleged mob played a role in his election in 1960, and Bobby Kennedy was fairly vigorous in his investigation and prosecution of organized crime. Nobody likes to be, you know, to be played for a dupe, especially members of organized crime. So I could see them having some type of role in a conspiracy.
What did the U.S. Secret Service do after the assassination? Did they fall apart? Because they knew Oswald.
See, here's the thing: the Secret Service is a really interesting agency. They were signed into law on April 14th, 1865. As a matter of fact, that was one of the last things that President Lincoln did before he left for Ford's Theater, was to sign the bill that came over from Congress.
Well, somebody was asleep at the wheel on that day.
Well, not really, because their job was to primarily investigate counterfeiting activities. And then, you know, several years later, we had President Garfield assassinated, and then we had President McKinley assassinated, and then it was around 1901, 1902 that
they wised up, huh?
Well, someone has to protect the president. Wouldn't be a good idea if we had people that do that. So they cast that with the Secret Service. And the presidential protection detail for President Roosevelt started at about eight guys, and I think only two of them were armed. Fast forward from, you know, 1902 to 1963, you have about 30-odd people on the president's detail. They were communicating by hand signals. They didn't even have, you know, small radios that we associate with them at the time. So presidential protection was still in its infancy in 1963, and certainly nothing anything like what it has right now. But every assassination attempt is, and I know it's crass to say this, it's a learning experience for the service. What could they do differently? What could they anticipate? How can they put themselves in the mindset of the shooter or the would-be assassin and protect the president? So we've seen, you know, growth, fantastic growth in the protective mission and the methods that they use to protect the president between 1963 and now. So I don't fault the Secret Service too much. There were allegations that members of the detail were out drinking and at strip clubs the night before. I'm not so sure if that's true or if it affects their performance on that day. But what we do have is Clint Hill, who, as far as I'm concerned, is a national hero, who was one of the first people to react.
He was the one who jumped on the back, right?
Jumped off the follow-up car, ran forward, pushed Mrs. Kennedy back in. And then there are actually some photos that are available that show the president's limo racing on the Stemmons Freeway towards Parkland Hospital.
And she was looking for parts of his brain, right?
Apparently so, yeah. I mean, you can actually see on the Zapruder film when the final shot came, a large chunk, you know, fly back off of his head. And, you know, I kind of feel bad for Mrs. Kennedy.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she had just lost a baby several weeks before. She normally didn't accompany him on domestic trips. I'm sure she was still somewhat tranquilized just because of the trauma.
Sure. But I'm sure also she was aware of his infidelities.
Oh, I'm sure she was as well, yeah. But I think she, you know, but I think
she put up with it. She played the
part. Relationship was their relationship, and I think, quite frankly, I think she loved him very much and was willing to put up with certain things that most people wouldn't.
Well, she was a dignified first lady, wasn't she?
Certainly was.
So you also looked at, and I talked the last hour with our guest about three tramps. How do they factor? Were they part of this?
Well, if you
who were they?
Well, I'm not exactly sure, but it's a funny thing because if you look at the Marianne Moorman photographs, okay, it clearly shows these three hobos standing on the steps leading up to the grassy knoll, and somebody had done a photo comparison back in the late 1970s. Where you compared basically the three hobos to photographs of the three hobos with photographs of E. Howard Hunt.
And Frank Sturgis.
Frank Sturgis and Eugenio Martinez. And the resemblance is
pretty uncanny.
Is really uncanny. But if you think about it for a moment, too, if you're the mayor of Dallas, and you know the president's coming to Dallas, you're going to have those street sweepers working 24 hours.
Absolutely.
You're going to trim the lawn. You're going to water it.
You're going to get homeless people out of the way.
But you're also going to fertilize the hell out of that lawn because you want it to be green. You want it to be verdant. You want it to be great picture of it. And when you test for gunpowder residue, at least under 1963 technology, one of the things you do is a paraffin test, and you're testing for the presence of nitrates, okay?
Right.
Because most fertilizers contain large amounts of nitrogen, if you fertilize your lawn and then do a paraffin test, it's going to look like you were firing a machine gun.
It's going to go through the roof.
It's going to be on your clothing. It's going to be everywhere. And there's a great photograph of these three hobos being led to the Dallas police station. But there's no record of their interview.
No. Or their release or anything.
Or their release or their even presence or their names.
Good point.
It's just an amazing story.
Paul, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you in our final half hour here as we wrap up the JFK assassination show. Okay, welcome back. Paul DiBolli with us. This is our final segment. He is a professor of political science. And is that in Newton, Massachusetts, Paul?
It is.
My mother was born in Fitchburg, about 40 miles west of that spot.
You know, there is an amazing Massachusetts connection to just about every successful venture in the United States. So.
Let's take some calls here for you. Joe in the Bronx, welcome to the show. Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George. Happy Thanksgiving,
Joe. You too, Joe.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving, Paul. I wanted to ask you concerning the ballistics on the Kennedy assassination, because I understand that John K. Latimer did the ballistics on the Kennedy assassination. Are they sure they know the number of shots that were fired at Kennedy, including the ones that actually hit him? And why was it necessary to invent the magic bullet theory, the theory that says that there was a bullet that went through Kennedy and went through Governor Connally?
Well, you know, the House Committee report that was released in the 1970s concluded that there was ample acoustical evidence to indicate that there was more than one bullet fired. And there's actually a couple of websites that actually show an oscillograph representation of radio transmissions received by the Dallas PD. And basically what happens is one of the motorcycle officers in the motorcade...
had his mic on, right?
Had his mic on, and so it was recorded on this old-fashioned, crappy dictabelt system. And if you look at the peaks and the valleys in that oscillograph, it indicates there could be as many as six or seven shots fired. And there's a willingness to put that off to a motorcycle backfiring or background noise. But again, the raised areas in the tape seem to be fairly specific, and it looks like it could be as many, again, as six or seven shots. There was one, you know, on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, there were three slugs that were recovered. Two of those slugs were very close to the window. One of it was somewhat far away. One of the theories is that one of those spent shells might have been still in the firing chamber as a placeholder to prevent buildup of dirt, dust, etc. in there, and that when Oswald took his shots, he cycled the bolt first, the chamber a live round, ejecting a spent slug, again, about 4 or 5 feet away from where the other two were found. There's also indication that there was excessive wear on that oddball, you know, off-site slug that could indicate that it was cycled through the weapon twice. That's powerful. I mean, Latimer's research was fantastic. And the one that keeps coming back to me, again, I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV, although sometimes I wish I did, is that when you see frame 313 on the Zapruder film, and again, you know, stop it and try and go through it frame by frame. When a person takes a headshot, the head's a very, very dense portion of the body. There's skin, there's bone, there's gray matter, there's cerebral fluid, there's blood, there's everything. And at the moment that bullet enters the skull, all of that material is displaced by the path of the bullet. And that material has no place to go until there's an exit wound. So what usually happens is it squirts out the entry wound, at least initially. So when you look at the Zapruder film, and when you look at the way that his head snapped back when he was receiving the shot, absorbing all of that kinetic energy, and that very, very fine mist, that pink cloud that extrudes from the front of his head, you know, most people are going to reasonably conclude that there was a shot coming from the front right. And I have to tell you, I've heard some explanations from a variety of people, including pathologists that I've asked questions of, and they all seem to say the same thing, that yes, it does, that's exactly what happens.
And there's no question, when you look at the Zapruder film, I mean, even at that young age when it finally came out,
yep,
I was convinced he was shot from the front.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think most of the doctors at Parkland Hospital were convinced.
Yeah, I mean, there was always this conflicting testimony at Parkland Hospital over what the doctors said. There was a Kennedy aide that came out, and based on his conversation with the doctors, seemed to indicate that the shot came from the front right by pointing to his head, et cetera. There is the autopsy notes. Well, not the autopsy notes. The notes from the ER indicating the status of the wounds. There were the autopsy notes that were performed by the doctor at Bethesda that were probably destroyed right afterwards, which seems to be a violation of so many laws that it's laughable. You know, I have to go by at least at least four or five, you know, if not six or seven. And the thing that's interesting about the magic bullet theory is that was the, that was pretty much something that was concocted to act by Alvin Specter to actually make the narrative work that there was only one shooter. But when you, I mean, when you think about it, one bullet goes through two people, causes seven wounds, okay? bounces off
and people believed it
and remains relatively pristine.
It doesn't happen.
Yeah, it doesn't happen at all.
The minute they hit bone, it should have, you know, smashed up.
Of course. There would have been much more deformity. And actually, when they recovered the bullet from the stretcher at Parkland Hospital, there was no indication that...
It was even
Governor
shot.
Conley was even on that stretcher. So, again, you know, was the bullet planted... I would have to say that there's a reasonable likelihood that that was, in fact, the case.
Did they think of everything, and how many people might have been involved in this?
You know, it would seem to be, it would have to be a fairly small number. There's a theoretical thing, formula out there, basically saying that the probability of keeping a conspiracy a secret is 1/2 raised to the power that.
So, I think they killed off everybody.
Yeah. So the more, well, I mean that we could run a whole course on the number of witnesses that have you know, died under mysterious circumstances in a very untimely way shortly after the assassination.
Paul, isn't it amazing too though that the high percent, the 80% of your class that believes it was a conspiracy, none of them was alive when Kennedy was killed.
Yeah, and they can look at it with a certain degree of objectivity too. I mean, I remember my parents talking about President Kennedy, and you know, there was this general, you know, optimism and euphoria that seemed to accompany the Kennedy presidency. And you know, kids nowadays are a little more cynical; they're a little more skeptical than perhaps we were.
They're smarter
at that time. Oh, I don't know about smarter. Believe me,
think they are.
At least they're a little more perceptive in some ways, and they can look at things through the lens of history, which is usually 20/20.
Let's go to Laura in Hallowell, Maine. Welcome to the program, Laura. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, George. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
My question is for you, George, but maybe both of you will answer, and then I have another question. I'd like to know what you think of Marilyn Monroe being part of and used by the deep state.
I'm not sure if she was used by it, but I'm sure they wanted to get her out of it because of her relationship with Kennedy and her brother Bobby, his brother Bobby. I think they were afraid she was gonna go public, and my guess is that she did not die of an overdose; that somebody killed her. Paul, what do you think?
I really try not to think too much about that. I'm not totally convinced that there was any involvement between Marilyn Monroe and Bobby, and for a variety of reasons. If you look at Bobby Kennedy's conduct up until that point, he was rather puritanical, and he pretty much spent most of his time cleaning up his brother's messes. When Jackie lost the first baby, you know, John was on a yacht trip somewhere, and it was Bobby that took care of Jackie at that point. So, you know, I would be hard pressed to assume any type of unwarranted relationship between Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe, but
you can't deny John.
You can't deny John, no.
What else you have, Laura?
I wanted to ask, my boyfriend told me a while back that he had heard that when President Trump was chosen, that you were the first person he called. And I was wondering if that is true.
No, it is not true.
True at all?
No, he hasn't called me at all yet.
Okay, he's probably, I just said it's not true.
Probably thinking of Alex Jones, one of our guests.
Oh, okay, perhaps that is it.
Yeah, that's pretty, I'm sure that is, because Alex used to have President Trump on before he was the president, and so there was a little reciprocity there at the end. Let's go back to more calls here as the time is starting to click away. Steve is in San Lorenzo, California with us now. Hi, Stephen, go ahead.
Hi, George, happy Thanksgiving.
You too, Steve.
I was calling about a couple of things, but the first one, there's the letter George Bush wrote about where he was that day. a lady named Jody Hansen. She wrote a bunch of people, celebrities, politicians, sports people, regular people, and asked them to tell them where they were that day. She made a book a few years ago with her daughter. It's called November 22nd, 1963. It came out a few years ago. I got it at a dollar store. I didn't know it existed. And in it, she has the story. It's dated August 25th, 1979. And he writes back, "Dear Ms. Hansen, thank you for your letter of August 10th. As to your query, I was in Tyler, Texas on November 22nd, 1963 to give a political speech. My initial reaction to the news that President Kennedy had been shot was disbelief and then a sense of horror once I finally realized it actually happened. That was a general reaction of the people I met that tragic day. I've enclosed the brochure and a campaign newsletter. I'd be most grateful if you can fit to support my candidacy for president. Thank you. Thanks again for writing. Hopefully our paths will cross. I'm in your area. Sincerely, George Bush."
Selective amnesia now, I guess, huh?
He forgets and he writes things down, I guess. But that's in a book you get for $2 at Barnes & Noble. It's hardcover, $2. But it has a bunch of different people. It's really interesting. There's a lot of people in there. But my second was, for a few years now, I've read a lot of stuff over the years, for years and years. I wasn't born. I was born way after, 8 years after. But I'm always wondering, a few years ago, I wondered, he took the gun into the book depository under his arm, supposedly, which people say it's too long, the longest part of the gun is done. But he never found a screwdriver or anything else. He had to take it apart and put it back together with a screwdriver. It was a military rifle. It wasn't like a sniper rifle you can take apart, snap back together. He had to screw the screws back together. And he never found a screwdriver on him or at the place. I've never seen anybody having a book how he put the rifle back together once he got it into the depository, how he put it back together to shoot Kennedy with it. I mean, he had to, what he'd use to...
What do you think of the rifle, Paul?
Well, first of all, it's a crappy gun.
It is horrible. Slow.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, if I was going to be involved in an assassination, I certainly wouldn't, have a rifle that we had to manually recycle the bolts to expend the spent round and chamber a new one.
And re-aim and everything else.
Re-aim, reacquire target, etc. But according to the witness who gave Oswald a ride to work, he had it wrapped in a blanket and said he was returning curtain rods on his lunch hour, which, again, for an Oswald-type guy, doesn't seem like a typical remark. But I wanted to go back to the Bush thing. There's a memo to file from the FBI dated November 22nd, November 23rd, 1963, about a Mr. George W. Bush basically calling the FBI to report information about a person that he had a conversation with, where the person threatened to kill President Kennedy. I think the person's last name was Parrott, P-A-R-R-O-T-T. So it's well documented where George Bush was on that day, and he was somewhere between Tyler and Dallas at the time. But the interesting thing was there was J. Edgar Hoover memorandum that indicates that he spoke with a George Bush at the CIA Operations Center in Langley, Virginia, shortly after the assassination. And there was a lot of, there was a big conspiracy theory involving, was George W. Bush, H.W. Bush actually in Texas? Was he working for the CIA in Langley? And apparently there were two George Bushes at the same time, one of whom was...
Go figure, right?
Yeah.
Paul, when you have your conspiracy course, do you do it yearly or quarterly? How often do you do it?
I do it every spring semester.
And is it packed with students?
Oh, and registration. Well, at LaSalle, we're really small, so we limit each class to 25. I could run multiple sections of that course if I had the time.
And what other conspiracies do you look at?
Well, one of my favorite ones is the Lincoln kidnapping. I think it's pretty well known that there was a plot to actually kidnap Abraham Lincoln, smuggle him across the Potomac into the South, and then ransom him back. Excuse me. Sorry about that. To the Northern forces, and use that as a way to finance the second Confederacy.
Because they were running out of money, that's for sure.
They were running out of money, they were running out of people, they were running out of just about everything that you need to successfully prosecute a war. So that's one of the more interesting theories behind that. There's also some theories kicking around that, and again, this kind of fits into the overall conspiracy vein, that John Wilkes Booth was not killed at Garrett's farm on April 26th, that he answered that that was actually a body double for him.
Oh, wow. That is a great story. Paul, we're out of time. I want to thank you for spending your pre-Thanksgiving night. Of course, it's Thanksgiving morning now in most areas. For Dan Galante, Donna Walker, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Alex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. We'll be live on Thanksgiving night. Until then, be safe, everyone.